Welcome to Whiskey Cast, the Cask Strength podcast featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 162 for September 14th, 2008. Coming up in a few minutes.
For a brand to survive this long is like, wow. And to be part of that rich history, it's phenomenal.
That's Dan Tullio of Canadian Club, which is celebrating its 150th anniversary starting this month. More on that with Dan later. But first, let's take a look at the news. A couple of new whiskeys to report on this week. Both will be duty-free exclusives. First off, the Balvenie has a whopper of an exclusive at Hong Kong's Sky Connection Airport Shop, a 1964 single-cask bottling. Only 151 bottles will be available at just over $14,000 U.S. each. Much more affordable and much easier to find, the Glenrothes will be releasing the new Robur Reserve Edition at duty-free shops starting this fall. The name comes from the Latin Quercus Robur, which refers to the European and Spanish oak wood that's in the first-fill sherry casks that make up most of the Robur Reserve. One-liter bottles will sell for about 50 euros, or about $70 U.S. at current exchange rates. There's also another newcomer from Glenmorangie. I had the chance to taste the Signet this past week with Dr. Bill Lumsden in New York. He says the genesis of the Signet dates all the way back to when he first got interested in single malts in 1984 while he was getting his PhD in brewing and distilling.
At that time also, I was looking at different raw materials involved in the production process, and I was particularly intrigued by some of the different cereal types that were used for the production of handcrafted beers, you know, and some of the traditional English ales. Things like roast barley, carapils, crystal malt, chocolate malt, things like that, which gave not only colour to the beer, but a very delicious range of flavours. And I thought, wouldn't it be fun if someone tried that in the distilling process? Now, it then took me many years after that before I got the opportunity to put it into practice. And it was once I became distillery manager at Glenmorangie, you know, kind of back in 1994. So I bought some chocolate malt, as we call it. And, you know, just to explain what that is, during the malting process, the barley grains are steeped in water for a couple of days. They're then germinated for anything between 4 and 6 days, and then they're dried in a kiln or an oven. However, if you subject them to a very high temperature regime, you can play tunes with the flavour profile. So so-called chocolate malt is kind of tumble roasted at a very high temperature, up to 250 degrees Celsius, which turns the grains look like little coffee beans, actually, but when you mash them to make your product, you get these flavours that can remind you of mocha or coffee or chocolate or things like that, hence the name. So there is no chocolate actually added to the process, but it's just the range of flavours you get from it. So I processed some of this in varying percentages of the overall malt bill and then laid it down in a variety of different cask types. As I say, that was about 10 or 11 years ago. And then I sampled regularly just to see, excuse me, how the product was developing. And, you know, it became apparent to me that if Glenmorangie Original is like cafe latte or cappuccino, you know, soft and creamy, the spirit from this chocolate malt was more like espresso, bittersweet, rich Turkish espresso coffee. Probably a little bit too strong to bottle on its own. So myself and my very able right-hand woman, Rachel Barry, started playing around with different recipes. And we've ended up, we started looking at this seriously over the last 2 years, and it's a very complicated recipe we've ended up with. There's some bits and pieces that only Rachel and I know, and we want to keep it that way. But essentially, there's several different cask types, ex-bourbon, ex-sherry, new charred oak, some of our Cadball barley malt, which gave a particularly creamy spirit, and it's top-dressed with some 34, 35-year-old Glenmorangie to end up with the product we're calling Signet today. And, you know, I wouldn't go as far as to say it's a risk, but it is very different from the other products in the Glenmorangie range, which all have a real family style to them. This is very rich, very deep, very intense, very rounded in flavor.
My tasting notes and score for the Signet are on the ratings page of the Whiskey Cast website. And on another front, Bill says a decision on the fate of Glenmurray should come in the next few weeks.
It's a fantastic little whiskey. It just wasn't as well known as Glenmorangie and Ardbeg. And because our new parent company wants us to focus very much on growing our two core malt brands, then Glenmurray, which over the years basically existed to supply whiskey for our blended needs, has become surplus to requirements. But you know, it's been a very well run distillery with, you know, Edwin Dodson, Graham Cool, my own involvement over the years, and it's in very good condition, and whoever buys that is going to be buying a little peach of a distillery there. And I'd like to think that whoever buys it will do something and focus more on the Glenmurray brand. And there's no doubt there was tremendous interest when it was put up for sale, you know, at least 10 definite notes of interest, and we're going through the process at the moment. And as I'm sure you know, distillation capacity is at a premium in the Scotch whisky industry. So Glenmurray will undoubtedly go into good hands, and there will probably be an announcement in October about who's going to be buying it.
I'll have the entire interview with Dr. Bill Lumsden on an upcoming episode of Whisky Cast. And one more note, there's also a new Ardbeg on the market in Europe. This one may inspire cries of blasphemy from some Ardbeg lovers. It's called Blasda, and it's lightly peated. I'll be tasting it next weekend at Whiskey Live Paris. I'll let you know what I think. And on that note, don't forget to listen for special coverage of Whiskey Live Paris. If the technology gods are smiling, I'll have episodes on both Saturday and Sunday from Paris. Time now for a look at the calendar of events brought to you by Laphroaig. Tickets are on sale now for Whiskey Fest New York on November 11th, and the folks at Malt Advocate have announced that this year's charity tasting table will benefit the Aubrey Fund for Pediatric Cancer Research at the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City. There are also just a few tickets left for Whiskey Fest San Francisco on October 10th, but here's how you can win two tickets for free. Longtime Whiskey Cast listener and spirits writer Camper English produces the site Alcademics.com, and people who sign up for his site's mailing list will be entered to win two tickets for the San Francisco Whiskey Fest. Now, 2009 marks the 40th anniversary of Woodstock, and the Brooklandis Whiskey Club in the Netherlands, no relationship to the distillery now, have decided to mark that anniversary with something they're calling Maltstock 09. They've tracked down 325 local whiskey clubs around the world and are inviting each and every one of those clubs to gather for a weekend in the Netherlands next September. If you're interested in either of these, there are links to both at the Whiskey Cast website. That's also where you'll find the rest of the calendar of events. It's brought to you by Laphroaig Quarter Cask. Become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Isla at Laphroaig.com. Canadian Club is one of the world's best-selling Canadian whiskies, and the brand celebrates its 150th anniversary starting this month. I tracked down Canadian Club's longtime brand ambassador, Dan Tullio, at the distillery in Windsor, Ontario.
Well, it all began with a gentleman by the name of Hiram Walker, and he was truly a Yankee Doodle Dandy, born on July 4th in 1816, in East Douglas, Massachusetts. And by the time he was 20 years old, he had acquired a chemical engineering certification at that time, and he traveled west like all fine young men, and he stopped in Detroit. And Detroit was a bustling fur trading center, an important stop here in the Great Lakes, and he established himself by opening up several different businesses. He was truly an entrepreneur. He had wood furniture making company. He was a tanner, but the one business that made him the most money was his grocery store chain, and the one commodity that made him the most money was the sale of beverage alcohol. So he was really fascinated, and again, being a chemical engineering kind of guy, he was really fascinated by whiskey, the manufacturing of whiskey, So what he did is he traveled down to Bourbon Country, to Scotland and Ireland, and he picked up the unique nuances of their indigenous style spirit. So by the time he was 40, he had amassed quite a bit of money with his businesses, and he felt that there was a temperance movement, that at some point in time it would become illegal to manufacture, sell, or consume beverage alcohol, and he said, well, doggone it, if that happens, I'm not going to be making as much money as I am today, because that's the one thing that makes me the most money in my stores, right? So what he did is he sold all of his businesses downtown Detroit, accumulated $40,000 back then, which is like millions today, looked across the Detroit River, and he purchased this tract of land, 468 acres, and that was in 1856. Within 2 years, he had his distillery up and running. He began to produce seven different styles of whiskey, one of which became very popular and fashionable in the finer gentlemen's clubs of the era, and it took on the name Club Whiskey. And if I could describe it, it was a lot lighter than a scotch and a lot smoother than a bourbon. And, of course, in the manufacturing of whiskey, if you tweak three specific things, and that is the ratio of grains used, the type of cask, or the length of maturation, you end up with a different taste profile product. Well, this brand took on some legs, the volume growth was quite good, to the point whereby the American bourbon guys down south became alarmed, because it began to impede on the sale of their bourbon whiskey. So they lobbied the U.S. government, to the point whereby the U.S. government came over here and demanded that Hiram Walker put the country of origin on the label, hoping to deter the sale of this brand. So lo and behold, Canadian Club was born. So that's how we got our start.
And, of course, patriotic Canadians would be very interested to know that their flagship whiskey was created by an American, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Actually, it was, I mean, just like in...
I am being facetious, of course.
Yeah. Well, in fact, as a result of that, Mark, sales further escalated for Canadian Club, because it gave it this cachet that it was an imported spirit. You know, similar to the scotches of the time. You know, it was imported, and it was a key point of differentiation. So by putting Canadian on there, and by putting on the eyebrow of the label by saying it was imported, it gave it that much more strength. And sales actually, in our records downstairs, in our archives, actually demonstrate that the sales volume increased as a result of that name change from Club Whiskey to Canadian Club. So that's how it all began.
And let's talk about the balance here, because you also talk about the grains, the maturation, and the casks and everything. But we know that most Canadian whiskey tended at the time to be made with rye, because that was the predominant grain in Canada at the time. Was that the case with Canadian Club?
No. In this particular area here in southwestern Ontario, the predominant grain is corn. We're actually in the corn belt. And about 60% of the grain that we purchase actually comes to us from the Michigan, Ohio, and Indiana area. And in the manufacturing of Canadian Club, we use four different types of grain. Corn, of course, is the least expensive of the grains, but it yields the highest amount of alcohol. And we also use rye malt, and barley malt. And those particular grains are referred to as the flavoring grains, because they create the blenders. Hiram Walker patented this proprietary process, and it's our whiskey, all brands within our flight, within the Canadian Club portfolio, are barrel blended. And what that means is that what the master blender and his staff do is they create a distillate from each one of these grains separately. And then at the end of the day, they blend those distillates according to recipe, and then we put it into the barrel for the 6-year period, or the 10-year period for reserve, 12 for classic 12. Okay? And in doing this, it allows the various distillates to marry. So if I can give you an analogy, let's say that we were given the task of making a stew. I think you would agree with me that if we cooked the meat in one pot and the parsley in the other and the potatoes in the other and the tomatoes, and then at the end of the day we put that all together, that would taste so much different versus if we were to cook all of those ingredients together. Same concept here. By blending those various distillates prior to aging, it allows the various distillates to marry, and that's what creates that smooth taste behind the Canadian Club family of brands, and it's a proprietary process.
Let's go back to the history now, because I know that a big part of the history centers on something that happened and something that really ended about a halfway point in Canadian Club's history about 75 years ago.
Yes.
It was the end of Prohibition. The years leading up to the end of Prohibition were really, really rather important ones for the Canadian Club brand, right?
Yes, that's right. You know, for that 13-year period, you know, I think I have no documentation to support this joke, but I think we were able to quench the thirst of our American friends. As I mentioned, Hiram Walker was truly an entrepreneur and a visionary, and the reason why he moved to Canada and bought this property in which I'm standing on right now is that he was concerned that at one point in time it would become illegal to manufacture, sell, or consume beverage alcohol. So he was right. 1920 comes around, December 5th, bingo. The United States goes dry, and his sons were involved in the business at that time. Because Hiram Walker passed away in 1899. So his three boys were involved in the business. And, being less than, let's say, one mile.
Yeah, a quick geography lesson here for people who aren't familiar with the difference between Detroit and Windsor. Detroit is basically separated from Windsor by the Detroit River, which is less than a mile wide. There are places where you could probably hit a golf ball across from country to country if you really wanted to swing it hard enough. And there's obviously very easy to get boats across, right?
That's correct. Yeah. And, I'm looking outside my office window here, and I'm looking right into Detroit, and it's less than a mile. And at one time, Mark, you know, the river used to freeze over. In fact, I've worked at the distillery here now for almost 28 years.
And as somebody who used to live in Detroit, I can say that occasionally the bullet fire comes across the river, too.
Correct.
My relatives and family in Michigan will get on me for this one, but I can say that having lived in Detroit.
Yeah. So there are a lot of transgressions that were going on. And, you know, we had some customers that were important to us. For example, the Purple Gang downtown Detroit. They basically controlled the border here. Al Capone, we have photographs of Mr. Capone here in this building, and I'm sure we had a number of dealings with him. During that time period, the sons of Hiram Walker created this bottle called the Gate Bottle, and basically it had a shortened neck to minimize the breakage of bottle during transport. It was also concave so that folks walking across the river through the tunnel to Detroit could hide it in their boot. Therefore, the word bootlegger came about. And the reason it was called a gate bottle is that the iron gates on the face of our building were actually part of the design of the bottle so that we could beef up the glass so that in the event that it fell, it wouldn't break. We also hired a very famous rum runner of the time, Bill McCoy. And we actually have his employment records downstairs, but Bill McCoy was our export dock manager at the time, and there are a lot of small little mom-and-pop shop distillers that were selling product to smugglers at the time, but everyone wanted Canadian Club, the real McCoy, and that's how we believe that term came about, because everyone would come across on the Canadian side, and there are a whole bunch of export docks. They say as many as 30 at one time, but they were always looking for the real McCoy, Canadian Club.
And that is a phrase that lives on to this day, as you mentioned.
There you go. Yes, sir. Yep. So, yes, pretty exciting times. Halfway through Prohibition, the Walker family sold the business to a prominent family by the name of Hatch. The Hatch family owned the company right up until 1987. So, it was a family-run business for many, many, many years. And sale of the brand accelerated towards the end of Prohibition, and on December 5th, 1933, Canadian Club was extremely well known across the United States.
Let's talk about 2008 now, because you're celebrating, starting basically in October, the 150th anniversary of Canadian Club. What's going to be done over the next year or so to celebrate the 150th anniversary?
Well, one of the key components is that we've been able to devise a commemorative bottle for this 150th anniversary, and we have 30-year-old product in the bottle, so I'm pretty excited about that. Canadian Club 30-year-old is the oldest whiskey ever released by any Canadian whiskey maker, and it's made in available in limited quantities in celebrating our 150th anniversary this year. In fact, we're producing 1,000 cases, and there are 6 bottles per case, so there aren't that many, and that's the world's requirement. That's what we're making available. You see, because what happens is that with this 30-year-old whiskey, every year the master blender has set aside casks, and every couple 3 years they would re-gauge these barrels by refilling them. Okay, because we experience about 6% evaporation loss per year per cask, and if you don't refill or re-gauge them, that's the term that we use in our industry, you end up with minimal amount of aging product at the bottom of the barrel, but a lot of head space, which increases the evaporation. So we want to make sure that those barrels were full almost 90% of the time, you see. So there are limited quantities, and we've just got enough to do 1,000 cases. So this whiskey, and we're going to be tasting it right now, it truly is a pinnacle of Canadian whiskey. I feel that it's an exceptional product crafted by proper aging and pre-barrel blending, the proprietary process.
And before we taste this, let me go into the mechanics of this a bit, because as you've pointed out, this is the oldest whiskey that's been put on the market by a Canadian distillery. Normally, the oldest that Canadian Club puts out is the 12-year-old, if I'm correct on that.
Yes.
So this has sort of been sitting around waiting for a special occasion to come about, such as
That's
the 150th
true.
Anniversary.
Yeah.
So this has been sort of in the planning stage for a while to release this as a 30?
Correct. Yeah, it's been in the planning stages for some time. I can be upfront and tell you that over the past, I've been here for 28 years now. Every year we set aside casks for special occasions, and the one that the most aged packaged bottle that I've seen prior to this one is a 20-year-old, which we make available for our Asian consumers in Japan, South Korea, and also duty-free on the west coast of the United States. But we have set aside casks, for our, 200-year celebration, which is going to be 50 years from now. So I'm really proud to be part of this, and it's an extraordinary whiskey, really bellies the senses, that's for sure.
Well, you have a glass of this, and I have a glass of this, and I'm nosing it right now, and I'm getting some of the plums and some of the raisins that are, as we've talked about before, completely different from the standard bottlings of Canadian Club.
Yes.
What is that? Where does that come from? Just in terms of the aging from the wood, from the maturation. Where do you think this came from over the time?
I have sat with the master blender. We've talked about this. And the very first thing that he has to say about this unique aroma and taste, which is unbelievable, is, number one, the pre-barrel blending process. By blending those various distillates together from corn, rye malt, and barley malt, really does allow them to marry. Okay, it's like that stew analogy that I gave before. Secondly, by re-gauging the barrels, and one could say it's truly a handcrafted whiskey because, you know, every couple, 3 years, the fellows out at the barrel aging warehouse facility, and by the way, we currently have 1.3 million barrels out there, you know, they kept on re-gauging the barrels. So let's say that they started out with 100, and every couple of years they would top them up. So after that term, you know, you might lose 6-7 barrels that got discarded. Now you've only got 92, and 2 or 3 years later, once again, they re-gauged them to a point whereby right now, you know, we have enough to do 1,000 cases. So by re-gauging the barrels, keeping them in proper temperature, and our warehouses are heated in the wintertime, therefore attributing to a consistent maturation rate, all of these components, you know, by re-gauging, blending prior to aging, heated warehouses, has created this wonderful spirit here.
Wow. I just took a sip of this, and I'm trying to find the right words to explain this. And
Cheers. I just took a little sippy poo myself. By the way, that's a Canadian word, sippy poo.
Sippy poo, eh?
Sippy poo, eh? Yeah. I find it to be so smooth and silky. In fact, I was making a presentation to some media writers last week in Toronto, and the one fellow said, it's not silky, it's satiny. Now, I don't even know if that's a word.
He said, well, the word that comes to me is well-balanced. Everything seems to be just very well-balanced on this. I mean, there's nothing that really sticks out. There's no nails that need to be pounded down on this one.
Right. Well, that's a good way to put it. You know, I get the initial sweetness up front.
Right.
My mouth is salivating. It tastes so good. Sorry about that. We get the initial sweetness up front. You get the burn on the back, just a minute burn.
Yeah.
Then you get the zestiness on the top of the tongue, you know, the acidity. So it's
almost syrupy at first.
Mm-hmm. Like, I find that it's got, like, very pure flavors. And, like, right now I'm getting chocolate, and I don't know why. Maybe it's because I'm a chocolate lover, but...
I'm getting dark chocolate
what
I'm getting.
Yeah.
I get the dark chocolate, like the really rich, dark,
yes.
Heavy on the cocoa chocolate.
Yes, exactly. Yep, very heavy, dark chocolate.
It really hits sort of at the top of the roof of the mouth and the sort of the back center part of the tongue as well.
Mm-hmm. It's got subtle spice as well, yeah, like dried fruit as well.
I'm getting some nutmeg, but I tend to get that in a lot of whiskeys for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
That may be just my tastes, but I get a lot of nutmeg in this one.
Mm-hmm.
And a little bit of cinnamon.
The dark chocolate I get, and I find it to be very pure flavors, you know.
Now, what else will be going on over the next year to celebrate? Because I can't imagine you're just going to let it go with this one special bottle and let it go at that.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to, for our upcoming holiday period, we're going to apply Necker's on bottles and to bring the point forward that, hey, we've been around since 1858. And, you know, that just, you know, reeks of history and heritage. And people, I think, like to be associated with something that's been around that long. I mean, I don't think any baby carriage or car or soda or anything has been around this long, you know, and for a brand to survive, and a lot of people today have got marketing savvy, for a brand to survive this long is like, wow, and to be part of that rich history, it's phenomenal.
Canadian Club was acquired by Beam Global in 2005 as part of the Allied Domecq breakup, but there's an interesting twist. Beam got the brand, but because there are several other brands produced at the Hiram Walker Distillery, the plant itself stayed in the hands of Pernod Ricard. The two companies have a 10-year agreement to keep producing Canadian Club at the distillery, and Beam will have to decide in the next several years whether to extend the agreement, buy the distillery, or, as a last resort, move production away from Windsor. Here's a bit of speculation on my part, though. Beam's award-winning Canadian Club Heritage Center at the distillery has a long-term lease that runs well into the next century, and I suspect production will stay in Windsor. That's all for this episode of WhiskeyCast. My email address for questions and suggestions is comments@whiskeycast.com, and I'd love to hear from you. You'll find links, whiskey ratings, the calendar of events, the WhiskeyCast store, and a complete archive of past episodes at the WhiskeyCast website. The address is www.whiskeycast.com. WhiskeyCast is a production of MG Media, copyright 2008, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.